need you to hate me. So I'll be your friend. America got a thing for this gangsta shit. They love me. Black Chuckers, Black Scully, leather Pele Pele. I take spit over rainbow shit. I'm a fan who got this silver duct tape on my tray handle. The women in my life bring confusion shit. So like Nina with New Jack, I'll cancel that bitch. Look at me. This is
the Hey, good afternoon.
Cold. Man, my heart controls. I build an empire on the load and I'll stone on the weather, man. I'll take that
cocoa. My name is, behavioral scientist Tanola Oliver, and this is the Making of the Mogul radio show, where the dream is free and the hustle is sold separately. So today I'm doing a follow-up. I seen one excerpt from an interview that Cat Williams did about Dayton, Ohio, and I just want to bring some redress to my perspective. For the city I grew up in, which is the city of Dayton, Ohio. He spoke very highly of it, and I agree. In the time period that we grew up, Dayton, Ohio was an amazing place. One moment, I'll be right back. And so I have less than 10 minutes to do this recording, and I intentionally waited until the last minute before I have to enter into a meeting, because I want my words to be very limited and strategic. And so as it relates to Dayton, Ohio, my memories growing up and having family that was very involved in the church community and in church leadership. When I was growing up, my grandmother was the president of the usher board. I remember going with her to the, I think it was like the regional usher board office. Back in the day, it was over on West 3rd Street, not far from the neighborhood that I grew up in. I remember the stories that my grandfather shared with me about building the railroads in the neighborhood of what is now known as the Wright-Dunbar District. I had the honor and privilege of raising my son in the Wright-Dunbar neighborhood. It was gentrified at the time I raised my son there, but it was still an honor and a privilege for me. I don't think that he understood the value as to what it meant to me to live in that neighborhood. I also had a great aunt that one of the first properties that she lived in or purchased, she lived in the neighborhood where I lived in, my grandmother's sister. And so when I tell you the city of Dayton used to have it going on, like we was a conglomerate of what Black power looked like, right? In various different ways, right? And so I agree with Cat Williams that the population at that time was 50-50. As we talk about the Black and white binary, it is no longer, the population no longer reflects African Americans being 50% of the population here. As the culture began to shift, a lot of people, particularly African Americans that were educated, began to move away. But Black people were an economic powerhouse in the city of Dayton when I was growing up. The programs that were built around the next generation of African American leadership was phenomenal. The tangible access to programs, whether it was recreation, arts, sciences, math, you name it. The Black community had the control of it, and we were able to distribute it appropriately amongst the inner city. And so Blackonomics in the city of Dayton when I was growing up was strategically about Black people supporting Black people, doing business with Black people, educating Black children with Black educators, and just working collaboratively as a community. As an economic development specialist, one of the things that I've noted most as it relates to migration and depopulation is that cities have to be very strategic and mindful when people move into regions from other regions. And that can actually be within the same state. I think one of the mistakes that the city of Dayton made, because we were a powerhouse, but we were like that small entity that had a lot of power, right? And the reason why a lot of artists and a lot of musicians were cultivated in the Dayton region, just like the Detroit region. There has always been a bridge between Detroit and Dayton culturally, right? I think the reason why we were one of those places that were frequent by artists, rappers, singers, hip hop artists, various celebrity platforms, is because there was a lot of Black money in the city of Dayton. One of the things that happens when a city is a Mecca, and when I say Mecca, I'm specifically talking about Black money and Black dollars, is that it attracts power-hungry people and oftentimes people with agendas and motives. And so as it relates to depopulation and migration, the existing leadership in the city has to be very strategic and careful about who they allow to enter into the ranks of leadership. Because I think, well, it's not about what I think. What I know is that it destroyed the Black leadership in the city of Dayton. And so oftentimes I've had conversations about where the breakdown of economic fortitude dissipated within the city of Dayton. And part of that was ushered in under a specific mayor. Just her not having the business sense or acumen to make appropriate decisions and not having the right advisors connected to her to help her make decisions. Now, maybe she had the advisors and didn't listen. And I want to say a caveat, because I know a lot of times when people think that if you Black, that you cannot say anything about a Black person, but I'm 100% pro-Black, right? But I'm not anti anything. But I think the reason why we're in the situations that we're in now, particularly in vicinities or regions like the city of Dayton, is we have not held Black people accountable when they misstep. And we can do that behind closed doors. And hear me, that I always start behind closed doors, okay? It is not me as an African-American woman and an intellectual to come to a public platform and demoralize anybody, particularly somebody who is African-American. So I have started behind closed doors, and here we are. So anyhow, there was a lot of financial decisions and a lot of predatory lending that was ushered into the Dayton vicinity under a specific leadership, mayoralship. And I talked about it a lot behind closed doors, because it was the component that began to break down the Black community and their ability to make effective economic decisions as it related to financing, saving money, and things of that nature. One of the same things that that particular mayor did was spent a lot of money trying to control where people lived at. Because originally the thing was, if you worked for the city of Dayton, you had to live in the city of Dayton. And from what I understand, this particular mayor had a personal issue with somebody and spent a lot of money. It was like six figures on investigating where they lived. For the purpose of terminating this person's employment. Now, here is the thing. I don't agree. Leadership matters. And so I understand the thinking, the strategic thinking behind what she was doing. And as a matter of fact, what I'm about to say builds upon the fact that I think her strategy was the right strategy. It was her approach that I didn't agree with. And it's why you have to have people that are disconnected from the politics, be able, such as myself, right? Behavioral scientists, as an advisor, right? Because sometimes you're so plugged into it and so close to it, you don't necessarily see the mistakes and the mishaps. Because a lot of times, unfortunately, some decisions can be emotional decisions and not necessarily the right economic decisions. And so I understand why she felt like people needed to live in the city, because that is how up until then, like once she spent all that money, they overturned it and you no longer had to live in the city of Dayton to work for the city of Dayton. But, and that's when the deterioration of the economics within the city began to break down. And so I understand her purpose, her reasoning, and her strategy for wanting to do that. It was the approach that was wrong. Instead of spending money to on private investigators to research why this particular person was, or whether this person was living outside of the city limits or not, they should have created an incentivized program that would encourage people to stay within the city, right? And then created checks and balances for it, right? That would have been a motivation for having people to continue to live in the city of Dayton, right? And as a matter of fact, this is not a demoralization of her leadership or her characterization, though I don't agree with a lot of decisions that she made. In fact, I wrote a 2-page letter years ago, when I was in a meeting, and doing business, and some very negative things were stated about her and her leadership and some things that she was doing behind closed doors, things that I should have never really been privy to the information. And so I wrote a 2-page letter to the, CEO of the organization, just letting him know that I was in support of her and that I didn't necessarily appreciate what was said about her in those meetings. And so, forwarding to my point before I end this is that, so there during that time, there was a shift. And because the city of Dayton is a small entity, we were always impressed with people who migrated from larger cities, right? We were always impressed with people who had influence from larger cities. And where we made a mistake is that we began to allow people to move into leadership in the city of Dayton because they look like us, to begin to be in leadership when they brought a lot of toxic politics and agendas with them. And it began to break down the composition of collaboration that we had within the Black community. And I expressed this, right? You know, I'm never without words. And so I had expressed this one time when I was invited to serve on some leadership teams and just began to express how I thought a lot of things that we, the decisions that we were making within the Black community, as it related to just strategic initiatives and how to move the Black community forward, didn't make sense economically, right? Like a lot of things that we did was political, but it didn't make economic sense. And that if we kept moving towards that, then the trajectory of the economic dollar, Black dollar in this particular region was going to dissipate. And it did. And so what happened when that shift happened, because Black people in leadership were no longer really Black people in leadership. Like we had people that looked like us in leadership, but they didn't necessarily support the Black initiative, right? And so they began to just be pawns in positions that brought a lot of toxic energy with them from the places that they migrated from. Because the larger a place, typically the more pronounced the politics will be, particularly within any demographic of people. And so what happened was when we began to promote people in leadership within this particular region who looked like us, but had agendas and motives just because of the environments that their leadership was cultivated in, it brought a lot of toxicity and began to break down the nucleus of the Black leadership in the city. And I've strategically seen a shift here lately where people within the Black community have started to make very strategic decisions and deciding that if, as a people, we're able, the only way that we're going to move forward and re-strategize and recalibrate and rebuild that type of power that we had, right? We used to have shared power in the city of Dayton as Black people. Now we don't. The only way that we're going to be able to do that is to move some of that toxicity that had migrated here and brought some of those agendas with them. Because their intentionality was just to block people who had more positive motives and didn't really play politics, right? And so that is my take on why the Black leadership in the city of Dayton is not as powerful as it used to be. And I'm not saying that as it relates to all leadership, but I'm saying that as strategically, right? As we weigh in on the totality of what Black leadership looks like in the city of Dayton now, there's very few of us that are making those strategic decisions, that are making them from a perspective of how can I empower my people, right? And that's what happens when, one, you have people in positions that don't necessarily have the competency to do it all. And here's the thing is nobody has the competency to do it all. But when they're not willing to extend an olive branch to bring in people who have the ability to do what they don't really know how to do because they don't want to share the power with someone that they feel like they don't have the ability to control, that's politics, right? And so at some point that has to shift. The Black community has to be able to make a decision that we need some leadership that we don't have the ability to control, but we know that we'll do the right thing, so that they continue to create a funnel of leadership within the community, or the Black leadership within this particular region is going to continue to dissipate, and people are going to continue to migrate to places where they feel that their voice, their culture, and their upbringing, their values, their morals, their integrity has a place and a safe space where they can raise their children. And so that is my take. That is my two cents. And I may do a follow-up to this, but probably not. My name is behavioral scientist Tanola Oliver. This is the Making of the Mogul radio show, where the dream is free, but the hustle is sold separately. And this is just me bringing some redress. Only reason why I weighed in on it is because I'm from Dayton, Ohio. And I do a lot of business outside of Dayton, Ohio. And just the things that I've been able to observe and to see and to experience. And so that's that. That's my redress of what I heard Cat Williams say about the city of Dayton. I totally agree. But that city of Dayton has been, it does not exist anymore. But I am hoping that we are leaning in a direction to bring that back into place, because there used to be a power dynamic within the Black community that had a voice without any outside influence pitting Black leadership against one another. All right. You can reach me at electleadershipacademy@gmail.com. My next conversation will be about ELA, Christian University, and just our mission to educate the next generation of leadership. And I look forward to having a conversation with you. You can always sow a seed at $SALTROOM. And I just want to give a shout out to the Black universities, the HBCUs, in whatever way they have supported my the work of my foundation, whether that is employing me to facilitate within their educational institutions, or partnering with us so that the students of ELA Christian University have the ability to move on to larger, higher learning institutions and earn a bachelor's degree. I'm humbled, and I'm humbled. And I don't want to leave out any PWI institutions, but this is what I want to say, that you have your place in society as well, as it relates to within the Black community. I just admonish you to have people in positions that are not there to block opportunities and doors for other people to enter into PWIs and do well, but to have people strategically in those positions that really represent the Black community and want to see Black people be able to matriculate into leadership in PWI institutions, as well as begin to cultivate a legacy in PWI institutions. I don't know that I shared this publicly, but about a year ago, I was interviewed at an Ivy League institution, and it was one of the best experiences I've had as it relates to interviews at higher learning institutions. It was much better than I anticipated, and I was honored and privileged that they took the time to consider my leadership and my work on a scholastic level, not as a Black woman, but as a woman, right? And then next, as a woman who has biblical values as a Black woman, right? Because that's not something that I hide. Anytime you pull up any information about me, if you Google me, you're always going to see my faith. And it was a, you know, it was a public institution, and that can be a turnoff sometimes to Black institutions. But what it said to me is that they needed someone like me to fill a space and a void in their public institution that comes with my experience, my brand, my culture, my race, and my brand of femininity, right? And I was honored to have had that experience. So I want to say to PWI institutions, when you see and hear me support HBCUs, it is because from a perspective of where society has shifted, and I'm not saying all HBCUs get it right, because we have some plants inside of HBCUs that are there to be disruptive and to be toxic. So I'm not saying that we all get it right. But what I'm saying is, from where we are standing right now in society, it seems like the safer place for Black people to send their children and know that they'll receive the emotional, psychological, spiritual, and educational support that they need to be the best versions of themselves. And what I'm saying to PWI institutions is, if you want to become some of those safe spaces, then you have to be willing to consider more people like me. You are not ignorant of when you encounter and interview people who come with a politics that is not healthy for the Black community. You know when you interview them, right? Opt out. Like I said, that PWI institution that I was interviewed for, the Ivy League institution, I have nothing bad to say about them. One of the better experiences that I've had in an interview session and an intellectual communication with the person that was interviewing me. She was interested in my scholastic work. She was interested in my culture. She was interested in what I had to bring to the table, all of the encompassing of my experiences as a woman, as a Black woman, as a faith-based woman, as a mother, as a former wife. She wanted to experience all of that, and she wanted all of that to be in that position. She just couldn't figure out how to make it work. And I remember when I seen them change the job description, it is up to you as PWI institutions to create environments for all of your students and all of your staff to be able to have those good experiences.